From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, prolonged kissing, improper contact, crime that pays, and more. We talk with Eddie Muller about his new book, Grindhouse, a history of adults-only cinema from the 1920s to the 70s. Films like The Road to Ruin, Escort Girl, The Orgy at Lil's Place, and Slaves in Bondage. Also, a sister to a rock and roll legend, we talk with Laura Joplin about her older sister, Janis Joplin. Laura wrote a book about Janis and read some of Janis's letters home on a new VH1 documentary. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the woman who he says virtually invented electric bass playing. And film critic John Powers reviews The Crucible. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Several news reports say President Clinton has settled on his national security team for his second term in office, and he's reportedly chosen UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright to be his new Secretary of State. The reports also say Mr. Clinton wants to tap retiring Maine Senator William Cohen as Defense Secretary. Cohen is a Republican. Mr. Clinton is to make an announcement about his security team in about an hour and a half. Foreign ministers meeting in London continue to assess Bosnia's progress in implementing the Dayton Peace Accords. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The thorny question of war crimes dominates today's agenda. The Dayton Agreement calls for the parties in Bosnia to cooperate with the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, but the vast majority of indicted war criminals, including the two most notorious, Bosnian Serbs Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, remain at large. Leaders of the international community have repeatedly made the point that until war criminals are brought to justice, it will be difficult to bring about reconciliation in Bosnia and reconstruction of the country. But it will take more than words to convince the Bosnian Serbs to arrest their leaders. Bosnian Serb spokesman Marko Gasic said the war crimes tribunal was a political show trial. In addition to war crimes, the representatives of more than 40 countries, as well as the international organizations involved in Bosnia, will look at economic development and the return of refugees to their homes. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
A federal grand jury has indicted the nation's largest auto dealer for allegedly conspiring to bribe Honda executives. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The charges against Rick Hendrick stem from an investigation of Honda's business practices that's been underway for several years. A number of car dealers across the country have been accused of bribing Honda executives in return for receiving more automobiles at their dealerships, or in some cases in return for the right to open more dealerships. Several Honda executives, employees, and dealers have already been prosecuted in connection with the bribery scheme, but none has been so prominent in the automobile business as Hendrick, a North Carolina businessman who owns more than 60 dealerships and is a major figure in stock car racing. According to the indictment, Hendrick paid Honda executives tens of thousands of dollars in cash bribes and paid one executive's mortgage payments for a house in California. Hendrick's attorney says his client will plead not guilty to the charges. I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Texaco Chairman Peter Bijor says the boycott against the oil company is having only limited results. Bijor says some individual dealers have been hurt by the civil rights action, but sales overall are unaffected. Last month, Texaco agreed to pay $176 million to settle a race discrimination lawsuit lodged by black employees. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 9.5 points at 6,413. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. A German court has convicted three members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party of membership in a terror organization that carried out attacks on Turkish stores in Germany. NPR's Edward Lifson reports from Berlin.
Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, is fighting the Turkish government for the establishment of an independent Kurdistan. They wanted to include parts of what is now eastern Turkey. Germany has become a target of PKK activity because so many Turks live here. The PKK has firebombed Turkish shops in Germany and murdered Turks, and the party has been banned. On Thursday, a court in Munich convicted three Kurdish men of being PKK terrorist operatives. During the two-month trial, the defendants denied the charges. The German court did not find the men guilty of involvement in any specific attack, but determined that they are agents of the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Two of the men were given suspended two-year sentences, and the third was sent to prison for 22 months. In Berlin, I'm Edward Lipson reporting.
Tension remains high in France after Tuesday's bombing of a subway car in Paris. Some 1,800 extra police and soldiers are patrolling cities. Some are carrying machine guns. France has also sealed its border crossings with Belgium, Germany, and Luxembourg. Barricades remain up at all schools across the country. No one has yet claimed responsibility for the blast, which killed two people and seriously injured 35. French officials say they suspect Algerian Muslim militants were behind the explosion. NASA waved off landing attempts by the space shuttle Columbia today because of bad weather at the Kennedy Space Center. The shuttle mission has been rather fluid this week. Columbia was originally supposed to return home today, and managers extended the mission until tomorrow. Then they changed it back to today because of impending bad weather. Now the astronauts will stay in orbit until tomorrow. Forecasters hope for better landing weather in Florida. There is a backup landing site at Edwards Air Force Base in California. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Here is a picture which takes you behind the doctor's office, detailing in clear, unwavering terms a subject matter unable to be shown in films up to now. In this old production, you will see the latest hygienic discoveries demonstrated and explained. Among them, the results of using hormone creams for bust development purposes and other breast development methods. A picture that dares to throw back the veil of secrecy which surrounds all too many marriages. Those in which careless wives and husbands jeopardize their marriages because of ignorance. The art of love must be learned. This can only be done through intelligent study of both anatomical and psychological aspects of love and marriage. This has been successfully accomplished in this unique film presentation. Remember the title, Mated.
Now there's a time-tested way to sell movie tickets. Promise to break a taboo for educational and edifying reasons, of course. We just heard one of the many come-ons used by the creators of the adults-only cinema of earlier decades. Of course, lots of adults-only movies didn't bother with the educational pretense. They just promised throbbing dramas of desire, sex, sin, and exotic thrills. My guest Eddie Muller has co-authored a new book called Grindhouse, The Forbidden World of Adults-Only Cinema. It's a history of the movie industry that thrived in the seedy parts of town, shamelessly exploiting people's fears and desires. Before we talk about the history of the grindhouse, let's hear what the word actually means.
Grindhouse is a theater that has no starting times. They just grind the movies all day long. The show kind of begins when the customer arrives. No intermissions.
And why is it done that way?
It's not really necessary in a lot of these theaters that are showing adults-only movies to have starting times because typically people like to enter when it's dark in the theater anyway. So you don't see them queuing up outside too often at a grindhouse. So that's it. It maximizes the run of a film, too. They just show all day long, no stopping.
All the films you write about are adults-only films. What separates these adults-only films from the rest of the movies in the theaters?
They all violated the Hays Code, which was a production code self-administered by the Hollywood studios. And they created a list of do's and don'ts, what was allowed and not allowed in Hollywood movies. And basically, Will Hays's list became the shooting script for all these adults-only films.
What were some of the taboos stipulated by the production code that the adults-only movies were happy to show?
Oh, well, it went from everything, just general moral tone was one thing, but then obviously nakedness was totally forbidden. But prolonged kissing scenes were forbidden. Any kind of improper contact between men and women was improper. Drunkenness was not to be shown. Of course, crime could not pay. Crime had to be punished in the movies. And all of this stuff went on in the adults-only movies. One of the distinctions, however, in the 1930s of the adults-only films was that they had this moral cloak that they wrapped their plots in to sort of say, we're really doing this for the edification of the public. These are the pitfalls that, the men that were going to see these, they were instructional lessons in how to keep your daughter from falling into a life of prostitution. And of course, the square up, as they called it, which came at the end of the film or the beginning of the film, put the moral stamp on it, saying this is all for the betterment of our society.
A lot of our listeners might be familiar with the film Reefer Madness, a film that marketed itself as a cautionary tale about the problems of youth and drugs, or, you know, problems of smoking marijuana. But it also showed a lot of people getting high, and that's really what brought people into the theaters.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, the person who made that movie made a lot of other adults-only films in that era, a lot of exploitation films in
right.
that era. What were some of the other films?
Well, that's Dwayne Esper that you're referring to. And Esper actually didn't make Reefer Madness. He bought the film for distribution.
So he marketed it.
Exactly, yeah. It was made by a church group in Southern California as a cautionary tale, just as you say. And Esper, who was a real showman, they called him King of the Road Shows, figured out that he could cut in the hot parts to Reefer Madness and show it on the Grindhouse circuit, cut them out, and still show it to school groups and church groups and things, so he would make money coming and going.
How are these films marketed and advertised?
Well, the people who made these films, and most of them were part of this cadre of exploitation road showmen called the 40 Thieves. And the 40 Thieves were spread all around the country, and they were all the men who would do what the Hollywood studios refused to do. But being a road showman, their backgrounds, by and large, were in the carnival. And they knew how to set up a show quick, get in, strike while the iron's hot, get out before the cops show up. That was how they did their business. But the shows they actually put on at the theaters were pretty extraordinary, because they would have live appearances in the lobby by, you know, they had this corpse that they would tote around with them and sell back and forth to each other, who was this old Wild West bandit named Elmer McCurdy. And they would have, very often they would have freaks. Esper, Dwayne Esper, bought the rights to Todd Browning's Freaks at one point, which was not really an adults-only movie. And he called it Nature's Mistakes, and did sell it as kind of some kind of promise of some weird sex thing in the film. And he ended up taking a whole group of freaks with him on the road to appear in the theater lobbies along with the screening of the film.
So, in other words, in the lobby, there'd be almost like a carny freak show.
Absolutely.
To get
yeah.
people into the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And like in a carnival, the marketing and ad campaign would promise what? Promise?
Sights you've never seen before. That's the whole thing. The adults-only business stems directly from the carnival. It's the tent show at the end of the Midway, where you have to be a little bit older to go down there. There's the barker out front. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Behind this curtain, you will see sights never before witnessed by any man. And that was the come-on, and it still is the come-on, and it's infallible. It never fails to make money.
So there seemed to be two different angles to get people into the theaters. One was the, you're going to see freaks and sex and like you've never seen before. And then the other come-on was, this edifying and educational film will teach you about the dangers of drugs or the dangers of unprotected sexuality.
Exactly.
So they get you from either end, the cautionary tale or the freak show explicit come
right.
on.
And sometimes the two intersected perfectly, and that's when you had the sex hygiene movie.
What was the sex hygiene movie?
Well, that was, these are the pitfalls of having sex.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I'll tell you, the collision of concepts in those movies is pretty astounding to witness. Invariably, these were movies about men of a good social station who succumb to temptation, usually on the eve of their marriage to some decent woman. You know, it's always the bachelor party, that stray cat at the bachelor party that this guy falls for. And the film then proceeds, once he has contracted this disease, the film will get into clinical examples of venereal disease. That was the big attraction. So the producers of these films would ferret out this old medical footage from a lot of it from the military, and they would splice this in. And, you know, again, it's the freak show thing. So you had your moral sex education movie and you had your freak show come on in one tight package.
And of course, that would be sexual, too, because you were being shown what, diseased genitals?
Exactly, yeah. And the first time a lot of people actually saw genitals on the big screen was nauseating. You know, it was sores and oozing pus and all. It was just absolutely awful.
Now, there's another category of exploitation films, of adults-only films, the jungle movie. What was the come on of the jungle movie?
Well, the thing that is so astounding about the jungle movie, or Guna Guna pictures, as they were called in the trade, was that you could actually see full nudity because the people were African American. And the strange thing in this was that state censor boards, this is particularly in the South, had this double standard, because to apply the same standards to the African American performers, and they were mostly performers, because although these masqueraded as documentaries from the, you know, dark heart of Africa, you know, they were, a lot of the hot footage was being shot in the hills outside Burbank with, you know, cocktail waitresses and things. And the censor boards in the South had this double standard that said, if we are concerned about the nudity of the African Americans, then we're putting them on the same social plane as all of the white people that we're worried about in these movies, you know. So if a Caucasian actress, you know, slipped her bra strap in a movie, whoa, this was hot stuff, and can we actually show that? But the African American women were allowed to go around topless in these jungle movies because they were, you know, there's no kind way to put it. I mean, these censors equated them more closely with the animals in the film than with the humans in the films.
My guest is Eddie Muller, co-author of the new book Grindhouse, The Forbidden World of Adults-Only Cinema. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eddie Muller, and we're talking about his new book, Grindhouse, The Forbidden World of Adults-Only Cinema. How did you find some of the early adults-only films that you needed to see in order to write this book?
Some of them on bootleg tape. Some of them are available now on videotape. There are some other cultural archaeologists out there who are actually digging up the films, and they are available. And I have to say that some of them are kind of tough to get through. The nudist camp movies are the most boring movies ever made.
What are the nudist camp movies?
In the early 1950s, there was a picture called The Garden of Eden that a fellow named Walter Bibo made. And this created, it was brought up on obscenity charges in New York State. And a judge there, Charles Desmond, ruled that nudity per se was not obscene. The only problem was is that the nude people couldn't really be doing anything in the movie. So this created nudist camp movies where you could see naked people. You really didn't see full frontal nudity. But, they would be engaged in such amorous activities as picnics and sack races and ping pong and things like this. But there was no contact of any kind allowed between these people. So, believe it or not, people paid good money to go see these nudist camp movies. They just wanted to see people naked. That was it.
And I think Russ Meyer, early in his career, did nudist camp films. Russ Meyer of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls and Faster Pussycat Kill Kill and Vixen and Super Vixen fame.
Mm-hmm. Well, this may be a fine distinction, but Russ Meyer actually created a genre known as the nudie cutie movie, which is distinct now, Terry, from the nudist camp movie.
Excuse me?
It was okay to leer in the nudie cutie movies. You had to keep a straight face when it was a nudist camp movie. But Russ Meyer got in there and said, we know what this is really all about. And so he made a picture called The Immoral Mr. Tees, which was like a cheesecake calendar come to life. And that just created, that really did sort of open the floodgates. And at that time, The Immoral Mr. Tees was the most successful adults-only movie ever made. Just did huge business wherever it played.
And what separated that from the Nudist Camp movie?
The Nudie Cutie movie, was funny. One of the mainstays of that genre is that in order to leer at the naked women in the movie, the male character had to be sort of a bumbling dolt. He had to seem harmless and not a threat to these women. So the women in Nudie Cutie movies are really presented sort of they're like all American goddesses, you know. They're just going about their daily chores and they're just gorgeous and beautiful. And the men are just saps. They're just bumbling dolts like out of some 1950s sitcom or something. And they're always getting into, you know, goofy entanglements, trying to be voyeurs. That's the whole point. But it was all about leering. Nudist camp movies, apparently, they were, but you would never know it from the film itself. So Russ Meyer changed all that. It was definitely about looking.
One of the things you write about in your book, Grindhouse, is how foreign films, foreign sex films, started entering American art houses, really changing the whole nature of sexuality in the films. And of it kind of combining the sense of, like, sophistication with the forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
What's a good example of that?
The first example of that the biggest example of that would be And God Created Woman, the Roger Vadim film with Bardot.
With Brigitte Bardot.
And with Brigitte Bardot. That was, at that time, when that came out in this country in 1956, that was the most successful foreign film ever to play in the United States.
I remember when I was young, you write a little bit about Brigitte Bardot, and you have a picture of her with like almost like a T-shirt and shorts or something, and she's soaking wet, and so this is, what she's wearing is very revealing. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was young, some of the ads with Sophia Loren, they did look like very exotic sexual films. I didn't think of her as like the most sophisticated actress. I thought of her as being these films where I wished I could go see them because they had this promise of really revealing, you know, things that you wouldn't get to see in other movies. Was she a kind of early symbol of the more like sophisticated art house approach to sex films?
Absolutely. Now, there's one particular image, I think the one that you're talking about, the soaking wet image. That's Sophia Loren. And that is from a Hollywood movie, amazingly enough. She had made a lot of movies in Italy where she was this, because the Italians did this earthy thing, you know, in all the neorealist movies. And Loren came over, and Hollywood, their approach was, I don't know how else to say this, was to make her wet. I mean, they threw water on her in every part that she played to get this revealing thing without actually being revealing. So, and she laughs about it. She used to say, you know, I spent my first 5 years in Hollywood just dripping wet in every movie I made.
The adults-only movies showed the kind of stuff that the Hollywood production code said you weren't allowed to see.
Right.
When the production code ended in the 60s and was replaced by an age-related rating system, how did that affect the grindhouse fare?
Well, it had the funny effect of legitimizing it, because the X became one of the ratings in the Motion Picture Association rating thing. There was the G and initially the M and the R and the X. But for some odd reason, they elected not to copyright the X like they did the other rating classifications, because they didn't want to really be associated. They didn't want to have Hollywood product associated with the adults only product. So they said, well, we'll say that it's X and it's forbidden and all this, but we'll just leave it to the adults only producers to kind of deal with it as they see fit. What they didn't realize is that it would have the effect initially of legitimizing adults only product, because I mean, the X was the perfect symbol to represent a forbidden movie. It was, again, it was, to go back to the carnival concept, I mean, this was the perfect simple symbol for the ultimate come on. You know, it's X. You'll see, you know, forbidden things in this movie. And so they splashed the X all over the ads, but it also legitimized these movies because the X was officially part of the motion picture rating system. And then, of course, things got really complicated when Midnight Cowboy, which was an X-rated film, won the Oscar for Best Picture. And this was all a great boon to the adults-only producers.
Having spent all this time watching movies that a lot of people would think of as being utterly depraved, what have you learned about American pop culture?
Well, you know, one of the things that I got out of it from the research is that there is a lot of humor in it when you look at the big picture. And you can kind of see how strange our ideas are about these things. And looking at it in that way, I was able to find a lot of humor in it. And I think that it is like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz or something, kind of pulling back the curtain and exposing this demon behind all these movies as being just this old carny guy who's saying, you know, excuse me, I was just trying to make a buck, you know, I'm sorry. Dave Friedman, who was a big help in making this book, said that I did this long interview with him, and he concluded it by saying, you know, I have made a really good living exploiting the fear, ignorance, and greed of the American public. And he was a little, he was not in any way ashamed of that, but it was kind of a admission on his part that, you know, that's what these people are trading in. And he said, but you know, the emotion that I most exploited was loneliness. He said, that's the audience that I was catering to, was all these people that went to the grindhouses were very, very lonely. You know, they were looking for something that they didn't have. And I thought that was kind of poignant on Dave's part.
Well, Eddie Muller, thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Eddie Muller's new book is called Grindhouse, The Forbidden World of Adults-Only Cinema. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Laura Joplin about her older sister, Janice. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us about one of rock's influential bass players, and film critic John Powers reviews The Crucible.
Oh! try some more. I said, try.
Try.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may not be aware of this, but if you own even a small stack of rock and roll or soul records, there's a good chance you have a few which feature one of the hardest-working, unknown women in the recording business. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has the story.
When the story of women in rock and roll is told, the focus always tends to be on performers, which, given the music's history until just recently, means singers. Even discounting the huge contributions of women who have owned record labels, run publishing houses, written songs, and managed performers, this still sells short one of rock and roll's most remarkable and influential women, Carole Kaye. Of course, if you're a bass player, you're way ahead of me. Carole Kaye virtually invented electric bass playing. You might even say she wrote the book on the electric bass, since her instruction book has been mandatory for bassists since it was first published. She was born 61 years ago in Everett, Washington, to a couple of musicians who moved to Los Angeles when Carole was six. At the age of 13, she picked up guitar and was so talented that she was teaching it a year later. She soon started appearing in jazz clubs, and in 1957, Bumps Blackwell, Sam Cooke's musical director, tapped her for a session. She was a quick study and a formidable technician, and word got around. She spent the next 6 years playing guitar in the studios. One day in 1963, the bassist didn't show up for a session, and she sat in, but used her guitar pick to lay out the lines. It was a new sound, and one that became identified with her.
We come on this loop, John B., my grandfather and me, around.
Here, on the backing track to the Beach Boys' Sloop John B., you can hear the clicking of her pick. She wound up on Beach Boys Records because she was a member of the Wrecking Crew, the studio band that Phil Spector preferred for his L.A. recordings. Along with drummer Hal Blaine, who recently called her the greatest person who ever picked up a bass, she played innumerable sessions for everything from commercials to film soundtracks to pop records.
The beat goes on, the beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La-da-da-da-dee, la-da-da-da-da.
Studio musicians, of course, are an anonymous bunch, as likely to be called in to disguise a more famous musician's inadequacies as anything. For instance, The Doors never had a bassist, but Light My Fire sure did.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
There are other sessions she played that have recently become the subject of a controversy. It's well known that another of the 60s major bassists was James Jamerson, who played in the Motown studio group The Funk Brothers. But Motown engineer Armin Steiner maintained a studio in L.A. where he'd cut demo versions of songs, then fly the finished tapes back to Detroit. Kay maintains that some of the finished recordings used track from the L.A. demos, and she might be right.
Now if you
One thing that is certain, though, is that her bass solos on one of the other of 1966's top hits.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle mood on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
Up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations.
Disgusted with the drug culture she saw invading the LA music scene, Kay quit, no doubt with a healthy savings account, in 1970. Since then, she's done occasional jazz work, produced a few records by friends like Hampton Hawes and Joe Pass, and played on some soundtracks. Although arthritis has hindered her lately, she's been talking with Brian Wilson about touring with the original Pet Sounds group to recreate the sound of that classic album. Whether you're aware of it or not, you've heard Carol Kay, be it with Barbara Streisand on The Way We Were, Simon and Garfunkel's Homeward Bound, The Monkees' I'm a Believer, or Isaac Hayes' theme from Shaft. And you've heard her echoes in the sound of anyone who's picked up an electric bass in the last 35 years.
Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward is currently living and writing in Berlin. Coming up, Janis Joplin's younger sister. This is Fresh Air. This week, VH1 is showing a documentary on the life of Janis Joplin as part of the series they're calling Legends Week. Joplin was a groundbreaking figure in rock. She was gutsy, sexy, and unpolished. She died of a heroin overdose in 1970 at the age of 27. She grew up in Port Arthur, Texas, but it was in San Francisco, the counterculture capital, that she first established herself. Her fame spread when she performed at the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival.
A window just looking out at the rain. Sitting down by my window just looking out at the rain. Some came along, honey grabbed a hold of me, and it felt like a ball and chain. So long. Yeah.
As Janis Joplin was living on the cutting edge of rock and roll, her younger sister Laura was at home with their parents and brother in Texas, keeping up with Janis through her letters home. Laura reprinted those letters in her biography of Janis, published in 1992. Laura reads some of those letters on the new VH1 documentary. I asked her to read one for us, dated June 6th, 1966.
I don't really know what's happening yet. Supposed to rehearse with the band this afternoon. After that, I guess I'll know whether I want to stay and do that for a while. Right now, my position is ambivalent. I'm glad I came, nice to see the city, a few friends, but I'm not at all sold on the idea of becoming the poor man's Cher. So I guess we'll see. I just want to tell you that I am trying to keep a level head about everything and not go overboard with enthusiasm. I'm sure you're both convinced my self-destructive streak has won out again, but I'm really trying. I do plan on coming back to school, unless, I must admit, this turns into a good thing. Chet is a very important man out here now, and he wanted me specifically to sing with this band. I haven't tried yet, so I can't say what I'm going to do. So far, I'm safe, well-fed, and nothing has been stolen. I'm awfully sorry to be such a disappointment to you. I understand your fears at my coming here and must admit I share them. But I really do think there's an awfully good chance I won't blow it this time. There's really nothing more I can say now. Guess I'll write more when I have more news. Until then, address all criticism to the above address. And please believe that you can't possibly want for me to be a winner more than I do. Love, Janis.
Laura Joplin, I'm wondering, you know, after hearing this letter in which your sister apologized to your parents for being a disappointment and she's saying, you know, I don't want to blow it this time, what was she referring to? In what sense was she a disappointment to your parents at that point?
Well, I think she's talking about the fact that she's dropped out of college a few times and that she went out to California once before and got in trouble with drugs and got very much on the edge and I think scared herself to death and felt that she, if she stayed out there, that she probably wouldn't be living much longer. And so she came home. And when she did, that was the first time in her life that she started listening to what my parents were really saying and trying to take advantage of, say, the wisdom of elders and others, going to see a psychologist and being serious about studying in college. And she was trying to live the kind of life that she felt was the one that our parents would think would be the best one for her. So here she is leaving that effort and going out again to California in a place where she's already blown it before.
Were there things that seemed to set Janis Joplin apart from her friends and schoolmates before she became famous and before those differences could be expressed through the counterculture?
Well, I think one thing that's important to understand is that Janis didn't set herself singly apart when she was in Texas. She, with a whole group of people, took up a different banner. And that banner was one that was laid out for them within the beatnik literature and beatnik culture, the beatnik music, the beatnik dress. One of the dominant themes, which spoke so strongly in this small southern town, had to do with racial equality. Because you remember that Janis grew up at a time when integration was just beginning. The marches were just starting, the sit-ins. And her time in high school and junior high was filled with those kinds of images in the paper and on the news. And it was the topic for her group, the fact that we lived in a very segregated southern town and that this was not right. And they found a strong source for believing in equality and believing in the qualities expressed in the beatnik literature and also in the black blues music. And all those things kind of came together. And certainly, as a group, set themselves apart from people that believed in the status quo in society.
I'm wondering if when Janis was a teenager, if you felt that she was comfortable about herself physically, if she felt attractive, if she felt self-conscious or comfortable in her body.
I think that Janis was pretty blatant that, you know, she felt that she was overweight and had pimples, and that, you know, her heart was grand and big and her mind was awesome, but that was she was judged too much by her size and her physique. And I think that there was a great deal of resentment that she had about it then. And the thing that I found interesting in doing research is that here Janis was singing this tremendous, powerful folk singer, and here she goes out to San Francisco and she's singing this awesome music. And you know when she became successful and made that leap is when she started wearing sexy clothes and showing a little cleavage. I mean, it made her angry that as soon as she was willing to play the game, then she got the accolades. But it was the same person and the same skill.
Do you think she liked it in a way, too, that her body, which had always been considered to be unattractive, was suddenly something everybody admired and wanted?
Oh, God, I think she loved it. Yeah, I mean, Janice's weight went up and down, but clearly you can see there's a lot of great photos of Janis where she took great pride in being beautiful, and even the whole idea that she had a quasi-nude, you know, pin-up type photo, art pin-up photo taken of her when she was first out in Haight-Ashbury and wrote home to my parents about it, saying, you know, can I send you one? You know, I mean, it hardly shows, you know, that she was really excited and thrilled that people were finding the Janis's body beautiful. Yes.
Do you remember the first time you saw your sister in concert?
Well, actually, the first time I saw Janis was in a concert with Big Brother and the Holding Company at, I believe, the Avalon Ballroom out in Haight-Ashbury. When she'd been out there one summer, my parents said, something's happening. And so we took a family trip out to California, and one of the things we did was get to go watch them perform. And it was pretty spectacular and very totally different. The music was loud, overpowering, and Janis was larger than life. I think that the audience was equally as interesting to watch as the people on stage for someone who was not at all in the scene. And I think that most people were very stoned, and rather than, say, dancing and moving along, it was as though they were all frozen in place, just kind of staring. It was different.
Oh, come on.
It said about you to your friends when your sister became a star? How did that change your identity in your circles?
I know that Janis's career affected my life, but Janis's career in terms of my friends, I think really being aware of it because of the press, was probably only a couple of years before she died. But she was only in the spotlight publicly for probably about 4 years, and it took a couple of those for her to get big enough to be recognized. And I think that for me, what was so big was her death. And everything else just pales in comparison. And when she died, it was such a traumatic thing that it changed my life significantly. So it's hard for me to see the other things, though I'm sure there were things there.
Your parents were obviously concerned about your sister's life of extremes and nonconformity and excess. Did they take any pleasure in her success?
Oh, a lot. Yeah. Yeah, I think Mother was very supportive. I mean, she had scrapbooks and, you know, letters and would send clothes and ideas about things, you know, songs, tried to very clearly be involved. I think that they went to all the shows that were anywhere close to our hometown. And, you know, that was the tenor of the letters and the correspondence and the telephone calls. But there was also the, you know, the questioning.
What were the conversations like in the house about her?
Mostly just, oh, I heard Janice was playing in such and such, you know, mm-hmm. those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there's kind of personal stuff for, you know, she called, she bought a house, or, wow, she got a new car, and this should be fun. And then every once in a while you'd have an idea that Janice got arrested in Florida for, you know, using profanity on stage. And you kind of go, oh, you know, it's like her life is clearly full of ups and downs.
Do you feel you've been able to maintain a sense of her as a person, as your sister, even after she became an icon?
I think that that was a challenge for me for many years, and have finally come to the realization that the sister that I knew, the memories that I have are mine, and they're inside me, and it's my relationship with her. And that's different than the woman who is a social icon. And the fans that have a relationship to her and where she speaks somewhere deep within them, that their relationship to her is just as powerful and just as meaningful to them. And I don't think that those necessarily have to be the same thing. So I look at it as that after her death, Janice developed a second career, and the second career is being a social icon. And a social icon's job essentially is to reflect back to people some aspects of that person's personality, which the society wants to use collectively at that point in time. So she's not a whole person. That's not what an icon is. They're a caricature of just portions of the personality.
Laura Joplin reads some of Janice's letters home on a VH1 documentary about Janice, which is running this week as part of their Legends series. Coming up, a review of the new film adaptation of The Crucible. This is Fresh Air. The Crucible is a new movie based on Arthur Miller's morality play about the Salem witch trials. Miller adapted his 1953 play for the screen. The film stars Daniel Day-Lewis as John Proctor and Winona Ryder as Abigail, the vengeful teenager whose fury stirs up the town. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
I don't know about you, but I resent it when a movie wants to improve me. It's fine if, along the way, almost by accident, a movie happens to teach me something. But I rebel when a filmmaker offers me a moral lesson surrounded by Hollywood trappings, like a vitamin coated with chocolate. But that's precisely what happens in The Crucible, a star-studded new film certain to be in the thick of the Oscar hunt. If you've taken a high school English class, you know the story all too well. It's 1692 in Salem, Massachusetts, and a group of teenage girls is caught dancing naked in the woods. Led by the ferocious Abigail Williams, who's played by Winona Ryder, they defend themselves by accusing other people of witchcraft. Their accusations set off a chain reaction of hysteria, in the town and in themselves. Soon, innocent people are being hanged as witches, and nobody's safe. Not even Principal John Proctor, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, nor his wife Elizabeth, an achingly devout woman magnificently portrayed by Joan Allen. Under the basilisk eye of Judge Danforth, played by the stage legend Paul Scofield, the witch trials specialize in Catch-22. Nothing proves your guilt more surely than insisting upon your innocence. The Crucible is based on Arthur Miller's 1953 play about the feeding frenzy that was McCarthyism. In adapting it for the screen 40 years later, Miller has pared back the story's political theme, turning it into a Freudianized portrait of social psychopathology. The mass hysteria is sparked by the Puritans' sexual repression, in particular their fear of teenage girls' sexuality. This libido-fueled panic gives the action a histrionic fervor that is often strident, yet ultimately deeply affecting. No scene this year is more touching than the climactic encounter between Proctor and his wife, when, after years of suspicion and coldness, they achieve a fleeting moment of pure love. All this is neatly orchestrated by Nicholas Heitner, the English theater director who made his screen debut with The Madness of King George. Heitner isn't much of a visual stylist, but he's extremely good with actors, be they full-fledged stars like Day-Lewis or undervalued performers like Bruce Davison, whose mealy-mouthed Reverend Paris sanctions a witch hunt to save his own job. The film's big surprise is Winona Ryder, who abandons her familiar good girl persona to play Abigail, a baleful creature goaded by the demons of eroticism and madness. She embodies the most dangerous undercurrents of Salem life, as when she warns the other girls that they'd better not back off from their story.
All of you, we danced. That is all. And mark this, let anyone breathe a word or the edge of a word about the other things, and I will come to you in the black of some terrible night, and I will bring with me a pointy reckoning that will shudder you. And you know I can do it.
Still, for all this sound and fury, the movie is surprisingly thin. The reason is simple. Despite its fame, The Crucible is a mediocre play, heavy-handed, manipulative, and exhaustingly self-important. Its best scenes are about personal relationships, Abigail's feeling of sexual betrayal, or Proctor's impacted love for his wife. But Miller isn't really very interested in people. He's more concerned with putting across a thumpingly obvious message about justice and mass hysteria. There's no moral tension in the movie, because everyone who sees it knows, at every moment, exactly how they should feel about everything. It's wrong to be as repressed as the Puritans. It's wrong to hang people for being witches. It's wrong to throw away standards of proof in a trial. It's wrong to condemn others out of a desire for conformity. Who could possibly disagree? Instead of challenging our preconceptions, The Crucible feeds our sense that we would never be like those ignorant, cold-hearted Puritans. By playing to our self-righteousness, it makes us as smug as the hanging judges we're supposed to condemn.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tenenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of A Life of Picasso, 1907-1917, The Painter of Modern Life by John Richardson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.